Hello, it's Tuesday 28th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Poet Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauerman from Czech in Asia.
On today's show, we're taking a look back over four months of the coronavirus.
There's a huge amount to discuss, so let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. To date, we're taking a look back across the first 4 months of 2020 and the impact of COVID-19 on travel, tourism, politics, economics, and daily living in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, Hannah, in some ways it seems like more than 4 months, doesn't it? Our lives have been completely transformed by COVID-19 and as they have been around the world. And everybody is just still very uncertain about what comes out of this. But we are trying to stay positive and plan for the next chapter and whatever comes next. And I have to say, Hannah, that I've really enjoyed working together over these past few months to chart the key events as we've gone through each stage of COVID-19. We launched the Southeast Asia Travel Show back in January, right at the start of the outbreak. And obviously since then, it's dominated our podcast discussions, our own work as well. And of course, the daily global news agenda. So first, as a quick recap, I just wanted to ask you, do you remember where and when you were when you first heard the news about the outbreak in Wuhan?
Oh, good question. I mean, I don't remember exactly where I was, actually. But one thing I do remember was that trip that I took to Thailand back in January. And I must have already been aware of coronavirus back then because I was at Don Mueang Airport, which is, you know, the low-cost terminal in Bangkok, waiting to fly home to KL. And it was filled, duty-free was filled with Chinese tourists. And I do remember thinking to myself, oh, maybe I'll just be a little bit careful around here. So I think at that point I had an awareness, but I can't say exactly when I remember. Do you? Do you remember when?
Yeah, I actually do. I was in the UK. It was the Christmas holidays. It was New Year's Eve. I was in my parents' house and I was watching the news and just heard these words of suspected pneumonia cases in Wuhan. And I have to say, my heart just sank at that point. I had a feeling that this was going to be something quite serious, but obviously not on the scale of what we've seen over the past 4 months.
No, exactly. And like you mentioned there, Gary, it was 31st of December 2019, so New Year's Eve, when the WHO country office in China was informed by the local authorities of some unexplained cases of pneumonia in Wuhan.
Yeah, it was. And a week later, on the 7th of January 2020, so right at the beginning of the year, the Chinese authorities identified the new type of coronavirus. So the genetics of the coronavirus, which is the same as SARS and MERS. This was obviously a new form. And at this time, the rest of the world was obviously pretty unsure about what would happen. So if we fast forward just 13 days, less than 2 weeks from there, on the 20th of January, this was when the first overseas cases were confirmed in Japan, Korea, and here in Southeast Asia in Thailand. And then one day later, on the 21st of January, the World Health Organization, the WHO, began publishing its daily situation reports on the coronavirus. And that, Hannah, was 98 days ago today.
Time flies. From that point, Singapore and Vietnam also confirmed their first case on 23 of January. And by the 1st of February, Vietnam and Brunei had banned Chinese visitor arrivals, and more countries did the same. But it wasn't until the 13th of March that India became one of the first countries in Asia to close its borders to all short-term visitors. Just 1 week later, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Malaysia followed suit.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Vietnam, Singapore, Laos, Brunei, and Myanmar also barred short-term visitors from their countries by the end of March. And then came the lockdowns.
But it was Malaysia that became the first country in our region to enforce a widespread and very strict nationwide lockdown on March the 18th. Many other Southeast Asian countries followed suit before Singapore finally implemented its circuit breaker measures on 7th of April.
Yep, that's 3 weeks ago now. So bringing it all up to date, yesterday the worldwide infections reached 3 million figure. That's just 12 days after hitting the 2 million total. And 24 days after passing 1 million on the 3rd of April. Here in Southeast Asia, Singapore has the most infections, 14,423, followed by Indonesia, which has 9,096, Philippines or the Sevens, 7,777, and Malaysia with 5,820. The lowest recorded cases in our region are Laos with just 19, Cambodia with 122, and Brunei with 138. Which, given the figures in the rest of the region, seem extremely low.
Yeah, especially as some of them share borders with China as well. So at present, Indonesia has recorded the most deaths in Southeast Asia, and they're at 765. That's followed by Philippines with 511. But Singapore, despite actually having the most number of cases, so over 14,000, it has only recorded 14 deaths. And that's actually the lowest figure for any country worldwide that has recorded over 10,000 COVID-19 cases. So they're doing pretty well to handle the illness once it's set in.
Yeah, and they've obviously been very, very strong on testing. I think their numbers represent just the amount of testing that they're doing right now, especially in those worker dormitory areas. So Hannah, that's a run through the chronology of the pandemic crisis as it is up to right now. But I wanted to discuss with you some of the things that we've learned over the past 4 months, and there are many of them, you know, both in our lives and in our careers. So I wanted to ask you, what are some of the things that you've really felt that we've learned during these past 4 months from the travel sector and also personally?
I mean, from the travel sector, I think we have just seen how fragile, how everything has just, you know, been balancing. And when something big like this comes along, it just disrupts everything. And I guess to another extent, how interconnected all the countries are now. You know, one big country, China, at the beginning is not traveling. What impact does that then have on the rest of Southeast Asia? What impact does that have on European arrivals? It's been interesting to and frightening also, I think, to see that kind of interdependability. I mean, on a personal level, it's been a massive adjustment for me having my my toddler at home full time when he's normally at childcare. So there's been a fair amount of learning to do a lot more juggling as well.
Yeah, and that's 6 weeks now. We're just completing 6 weeks of lockdown here in Malaysia.
Yeah, crazy. How about you? What have you learned?
Yeah, and as you said there in the intro, we've had a pretty strict lockdown as well. So it's been, I would say, you know, personally for me, one of the biggest learnings is coming to terms with a lockdown. It's something I've never experienced before. And just watching the way the country has responded, I've been very impressed. I think, the government orders have been pretty well followed here. We've got the numbers down across the country quite low. Obviously, the biggest issue now is the exit path, how we get out of this and what happens next. And that's raising a lot of questions at the moment. In terms of the wider scale, well, I think obviously the key point is just how unprepared the world was for a pandemic. We've been warned about this many, many times. We've had outbreaks of Ebola and H1N1, MERS, they've all happened in recent times. This wasn't unexpected, but the whole world has completely melted down. And the interesting thing is just the different rates that countries have responded as well. Obviously, in Asia, I think some of the countries that learned from SARS, so you're looking particularly at South Korea, you look at Taiwan, you look at Hong Kong, they got onto testing very, very quickly. They closed their borders very, very quickly. They reacted very, very fast, and they've managed to contain the virus quite well. Interesting, countries like Australia and New Zealand, which are island nations, they were able to isolate themselves quite quickly. They shut down their economies quite fast, and they seem to have made big strides in containing this virus. But then you look at Europe, you look at North America, and it's been, you know, a real hodgepodge of mismanagement in many cases, and it hasn't really helped the global situation. So as we look now at coming forward into a recovery period, the whole world is at such different stages with this, and most of that is down to a lack of pre-planning, and that's going to impact the travel sector for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember saying to you, actually, I think maybe just before the lockdown was happening in Malaysia, I think that I was really disappointed and almost angry, actually, with Europe for the lack of a reaction to this, and almost arrogance, I think, at looking at what was happening in Asia, but thinking, oh no, you know, that's not going to happen to us, or they're just overreacting, there's no need to lock down the whole country.
But it can be done. I mean, you look at Germany, and they are proof positive that, you know, if you do prepare, you do test rigorously, you know, you can make big strides in a region, you know, where so many of your neighbouring countries are struggling. You know, they've been very, very impressive in the way they've managed this. And the other factor, of course, for us all, is just the way that the coronavirus has changed the language of daily living.
It is. It's funny, isn't it? And it's almost without thinking. So we thought for a little bit of lighthearted fun, and there's not much lighthearted you can really do about COVID-19, but we'll try our best, right? Is to put together a COVID-19 bingo, the list of a few words and phrases that we say now that we would never have considered using this time last year. So Gary, go first. What's your kind of top pick of COVID-19 bingo phrases?
Okay, well, I'll come to those in a minute, but I think the one that we all use that we probably, I don't think we ever used before, is the WHO, the World Health Organization. I mean, that never really entered any conversations that I'd ever used, but we use that absolutely everything in what we write and what we say and what we analyze right now. So the WHO, you know, that's probably the abbreviation of the last 4 months. But the name of the virus itself, you know, if we go back to the beginning of this outbreak, it became the new coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. And then that kind of got shortened a little bit because it is quite long. And we mostly use coronavirus. But the WHO then sort of made a distinction, and we got the name of the actual disease, COVID-19, which is coronavirus disease 2019. So that's the actual name of the disease, whereas the coronavirus is the name of the virus.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was kind of interesting how the news around that time when they were renaming it and the reasons behind it was, you know, they had seen in the past that people would start calling these things, you know, the Chinese flu or Chinese SARS. And, you know, they didn't want to risk that that would happen because they saw, you know, you then can end up with a lot of racism inherent because people are just connected to China. I mean, and certainly even with the name COVID-19, we have seen that. But I think it's so widespread now that people are almost kind of forgetting that it originally came from China because so many other countries have had so many more cases than China itself.
Absolutely. 100% agree. So what about yourself? What are your picks?
I think one of my picks, well, it's got to be lockdown or I love all the different names, actually, that different countries have come up for this to avoid using the word lockdown. That's probably the more interesting thing. So you've got your state of emergency. In Malaysia, it's the movement control order. Singapore is the circuit breaker. Indonesia is large scale social restrictions. Philippines, you've got the enhanced community quarantine. I mean, I think the lengths that governments will go to avoid using the word lockdown is pretty neat, but essentially it's lockdown. How about you? What's next?
Well, obviously, social distancing. That's, again, not something I ever used before. And the social distancing is quite a strange word because actually what you're talking about is physical distancing. It's, you know, you can still, social means you can still talk to people, you can still chat them from a distance, but, you know, we have to keep two meters apart. And, you know, as we're being advised now by scientists and even governments, you know, these social distancing regulations and restrictions will be in place for a long time to come. We have to be prepared for second waves, third waves, you know, whatever. So social distancing has become part of our lives, which we certainly wouldn't have expected back in December last year.
I think my next pick is probably PPE. That's a good one. Personal protective equipment. And it's actually kind of interesting because I think in Southeast Asia, this has not been so much of an issue. You know, frontline workers being able to access, you know, personal protective equipment. And even, I don't know, Gary, if you saw the news last night or this morning, Air Asia, air stewards and stewardesses have now even got their own Air Asia PPE that they are wearing in the cabins on flights.
I did see that.
Which also look a little bit frightening, I think, if anyone's, I definitely would not feel comfortable if my air steward was wearing that. But, you know, it's easy to get here in Asia, but of course, a lot of it is actually produced here in Asia. But if you're looking at countries like Europe, the UK, where we're from, you know, that's a big, big issue at the moment. Frontline workers not being able to access the right PPE or enough PPE, you know, to stop them contracting the disease.
Yeah, 100%. Well, my next pick, it's a double pick, is travel bans and border closures. And we work in the travel sector over the past, what, 5, 6, 7, or 8 years. We've had a boom time. Travel has really, really, really developed and expanded fast in Asia Pacific region. We just would never have predicted that we would be banned, locked down, and that borders would be closed. It just was unimaginable. And still is. It's still quite a hard thing to come to terms with. And as we were saying earlier, another phrase that will come up over the next few weeks is the exit strategy. You know, how do we start opening borders? Will we start opening borders? You know, will there just be mostly domestic travel for the foreseeable future? We just don't know. But, you know, there was just no way that we would have expected a travel ban globally would be in place right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I think especially as an expat, living so far away from home, that's a bit of a weird one as well, isn't it? Because you've always been able to take for granted that we'd be able to go back to the UK, go back home if you needed to, if something happened. And now, well, who knows if you'd managed to make it back there, you know? So it's an interesting one psychologically, I think, to deal with.
Yeah, true. Next pick.
Next pick for me is happy birthday.
Now, you had to explain this one to me because I didn't realize this.
You didn't know this? Oh, this is actually something that I have known. I used to do before coronavirus because my mother-in-law told me about it. But, you know, we're all told that we have to wash our hands, and you're meant to wash your hands for 20 seconds. And what you're always told is to reach that 20 seconds, how do you know, is if you sing Happy Birthday, the song, twice. And that is approximately 20 seconds. If you sing it twice, then you're done. You've washed your hands properly. So, I mean, I've been singing Happy Birthday under my breath for God knows how many months now. There have even all sorts of funny articles that have come out with alternatives that you can sing to yourself instead of Happy Birthday. So a good one is the chorus of Karma Chameleon. You could sing a chorus to Jolene by Dolly Parton. There's quite a few, you know. So if you are bored of Happy Birthday, go Google it. There are alternatives out there for you.
That's maybe the best advice of the whole podcast, Hannah. I like that one. Okay, so my next two picks are slightly different. One is where this virus actually come from. It's the word zoonotic, which I had never heard from. I'd never heard of before. And that's obviously the fact that the transmission of a disease from animals to humans. I'd never heard of zoonotic before. And the other one that I guess we'd heard of before, but we never used it, was asymptomatic, which has been one of the key issues. There's still so much we don't know about coronavirus. And there still seems to be quite a lot that scientists don't know about coronavirus. And one of the key non-learnings has been asymptomatic patients and how some people actually contract the virus but don't show any symptoms, but are still can transmit the virus. And this has caused, you know, we don't know how many transmissions around the world, but probably has been a large part of community transmissions in each country that has a high number of cases.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Is that enough coronavirus bingo, do you reckon?
I think it is. Just one more, and that's related to the exit strategy. And the key element there is phased lifting. So it's not just the case that normal life restarts anytime soon. These restrictions will be phased over periods of time. You know, the initial lifting will be a big psychological boost for people in countries that are locked down. I think we've seen this week that Spain, just a few restrictions were lifted, allowing people to go out and take exercise and things like that. You know, that's very important psychologically and for mental health as well as physical health.
Yeah, exactly. And we saw last week Vietnam started to lift their lockdown restrictions as well, even in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh. So I think that was something positive, at least, to see within Southeast Asia. The country is finally exiting this kind of lockdown period.
So let's start discussing some of the key impact areas of COVID-19 for travel and tourism here in Southeast Asia, Hannah. And we've identified seven key areas. So Hannah, let's begin with the arrivals figures, which, you know, travel and tourism at the moment is pretty much locked down. What have been some of the trends we've noticed, certainly at the beginning period of this crisis?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one. So we've had four countries that have really been quite open about their arrivals numbers. This is Vietnam, Indonesia, Thailand, and Singapore. And if you look at countries like Vietnam and Indonesia, in January, they were actually up. So Vietnam was actually up 32.8% versus January last year. So that's a huge jump, considering it was January and you were thinking maybe it would go down. But it was doing really well. And I think it was still at that point where they hadn't really closed borders yet. They were still allowing mainland Chinese to travel. China hadn't banned outbound tour groups. Vietnam had very few cases. Whereas if you look at a country like Singapore in January, they were still up. They were 3.9%. But I think that was a lot less than what they were expecting. And that's because at that time in January, Singapore was starting to have one of the biggest number of cases outside of China.
Yep.
And then it carries on. So if you look at February for Singapore, it was actually down 51%. And again, this is really where you can see that effect of people deciding not to travel to Singapore. So not just mainland Chinese, and of course mainland Chinese are a massive source market for Singapore, but other countries were also reconsidering kind of non-essential travel to Singapore. If you are looking at countries like Indonesia, February was still just down minus 28.9%. So you've got Indonesia minus 28.9%, Singapore down 51% in February, Thailand down almost 43%. And again, Thailand had quite a large number of coronavirus cases. It was, I think, the first country to have a case of COVID-19 outside of China. And so it's the funny impact that that perception of whether a country is safe or not to travel has had on those arrival numbers. And of course, now when we look back at these arrival numbers, not the arrival numbers, so if you, when we look back at the case numbers, it's very little. I think Singapore must have had less than 100 probably at the time. And everyone was really worried about traveling there. And now you look at countries that have got over 200,000 cases. So you kind of look back and think, what we were worrying about, just 100 cases.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, the second quarter figures are going to be pretty horrific. There was been pretty much zero travel during April. May, we don't know. Most airlines aren't flying in April, so or May. And, you know, the focus then will shift to maybe June, July, we'll focus on domestic travel. So arrivals figures, you know, we're not going to be looking at any growth there for some period of time.
Yeah, exactly.
Which brings us to one of the key elements. Obviously, the decline in arrivals figures and the decline of tourism completely has prompted some government responses. Governments have had to respond and stimulate their economies because there's just no revenue for a lot of sectors. Travel's one of them, but pretty much everybody is not able to make any money right now. So we've seen varied levels across the region, haven't we, Hannah? And Singapore, I think, probably has made the biggest strides, but you know, that's probably because it can afford to. It has probably greater reserves than some of the other countries in the region. And I think one of the most impressive speeches that I've seen during the whole crisis was by Singapore's Deputy Prime Minister, which I think was back on the 26th of March when he gave his, what he called it, the second assistance budget, where they actually tried to dig the country out of a hole and actually support not just the travel sector, but people on low incomes, small businesses, the elderly population. It was quite a wide-ranging budget. But related to travel, I mean, he made a couple of very, very important points. And he said that Changi Airport itself is such an important pillar of the Singapore economy. It contributes around 5% of Singapore's GDP and employs 192,000 people. He also said that the air hub supports other economic sectors, not just tourism, as well as manufacturing and logistics, and it anchors aerospace companies like Rolls-Royce and Airbus in the country, which are obviously very, very important. Singapore's aviation, he said, is a strategic asset, and it has significant linkages to the rest of the economy. If it collapses in a crisis, the recovery of the rest of the economy will be impeded. And you know, that obviously resonates around the whole of the region. Airports have become the center of economic activity over the last decade.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. Singapore has really, in terms of the measures that they have provided, especially towards the tourism sector, have really been second to none. They're really kind of leading the pack. And not only just in terms of measures, but in terms of thinking towards recovery as well. So, you know, launching their SG Clean, which is a scheme that really wants to certify hotels that they're clean and attractions and shopping malls and everything, because they recognize that when people are going to be traveling after this, they're going to be looking for assurance that, you know, things are hygienic and that things are clean, and that they need to start that now, which is a lot of forward thinking. And you've even seen now kind of Thailand is following suit. So they announced last week that the Tourism Authority of Thailand would also be launching their own kind of hygiene scheme. So it will be interesting to see if other countries also follow suit, but I should imagine that they will.
Yeah, and the main problem also for the travel sector has been supporting, you know, small businesses, travel agents, tour operators. And I think we've seen in the past couple of weeks articles in the Vietnamese and the Indonesian press saying, you know, 80, even 90% of small businesses in the tourism sector are really, really struggling. They're running out of cash. I guess it's the same here in Malaysia as well. I was also reading another article in Myanmar Times yesterday saying that, you know, the measures that have been taken so far to support small businesses are just too small. So, you know, this is going to endure as lockdowns are lifted. The pressure on the smallest companies in our sector is going to be huge. And if they run out of cash, then that's the end. There's not going to be any way back for them.
Yeah. I mean, and I know a lot of Malaysian travel agents here. And yeah, they are desperately trying to survive now. The government are subsidizing some of the wages, but only up to a certain salary point. Everyone's being asked to take pay cuts or take unpaid leave or be furloughed. It's a pretty grim situation, I think, to be working at a travel agency right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So from, you know, from the smaller end of the market right to the top end, you know, the sector that greases the pole for the whole of tourism, which is the artery, is the airlines and the airports. Mm-hmm. You know, the air sector is just completely shut down. You know, we know that capacities are in some cases down 96%. I think Singapore Airlines at the moment is flying less than 4% of its actual total capacity. That occurs for most airlines across the region. So the impact there has been huge. Obviously, airlines have huge costs day in, day out. And I was noticing there was an article yesterday by Bloomberg, which said that around the world, you know, there is this pressure now to rescue airlines, because if they don't, most of them will go bust. So there's two elements to this. There are the state carriers, which there's more pressure on governments to rescue. And then there are private carriers who, you know, they're going to find it harder to get state funding, so they're tending to turn more to private financing and bank loans. But Bloomberg said that up to yesterday, around $31 billion US dollars had been secured by major airlines around the world from governments and banks. Now, $20 billion of that was in the Americas, $6.83 billion is in Europe, and $4.1 billion is in Asia. But the interesting point it made about Asia is there are a lot of pending deals that haven't yet happened. So that $4.1 billion of airline loans that have been granted already includes China Airlines and EVA Airways in Taiwan and Singapore Airlines. But loan deals are currently pending for Japan's ANA, Emirates. And yesterday there was an announcement that eight Thailand-based carriers are seeking to raise up to $771 million US dollars from the government in order just to keep running. And those airlines include Bangkok Airways, NOC, Thai Air Asia, Thai Air Asia X, and Thai Lion Air. So these are major airlines for our region. You know, these low-cost carriers that take people several times a day between the cities around the region. They're really, really struggling right now.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see this in Indonesia coming soon, because Indonesia have been kind of protected somewhat, because they've had a lot of domestic flights still flying. But last week, Jokowi decreed that there would be no domestic flights, I think, until the 1st of June. And so, yeah, that's, you think of how many planes there are in Indonesia. I mean, Lion Air, I think, is one of the biggest fleets in the world. It's going to have major, major, major impact for these guys. And I can't imagine they've got much cash in the bank left right now to sustain that kind of the size of a fleet.
No, and here in Malaysia, obviously, Malaysia Airlines has been losing, you know, hand over fist for years and years and years. There have been issues. You know, the government was hoping it would be taken over. They were trying to sell the airline. There's rumors it may merge with Air Asia, but Air Asia at the moment is in deep financial trouble. So both those airlines are in a mess, and there's rumors perhaps they will merge, but you know, if they do, that's not great for the consumer. There's going to be a long way out of this crisis for some of these airlines, and even if they do manage to secure funding, well, that's going to be loan funding, so they're going to have to pay that money back, and you know, the possibility there is that they're going to have to offset their costs and pass them on to consumers. So, you know, we could be expecting higher fares.
Yeah, I mean, the only ray of sunshine I can add to this is that in Vietnam last week, finally, the domestic airlines, airlines started flying domestic routes again. So I think Vietnam Airlines is up to about 30% of its scheduled capacity, which I think it was at about almost close to zero during its lockdown. So it will be interesting to see how it does in Vietnam. And that will be kind of a test case, I suppose, for how it's going to work in the rest of Southeast Asia in terms of recovery.
Yeah. And then this goes deeper. Of course, it goes to the airports, which, you know, a lot of them are state run, but a lot of them aren't. A lot of them privately run. So, you know, they're not actually earning any revenue right now. And then you look at the airplane manufacturers. I mean, the two biggest manufacturers in the world, Airbus and Boeing, they're both seeking financial bailouts, one from European institutions and the other from the US government. And actually, the CEO of Boeing yesterday said that it will take 2 to 3 years for travel to return to 2019 levels, and an additional few years beyond that for the industry's long-term growth trend to return. He said that at the moment, airlines are grounding fleets, deferring airplane orders, postponing acceptance of completed orders, and slowing down or stopping payments. So the whole chain in the aircraft sector has just completely ground to a halt.
Mm. Looking at hotels now, and of course, you know, if people are not traveling, either domestically or internationally, then hotels won't be filled. So we've really seen occupancy rates drop massively over the different countries.
Yep, this affects across the sector, from the large five-star hotels right down to small privately owned motels and guest houses. They're all absolutely struggling. Most are closed, you know, across our region, whether that's in cities, whether that's by coastal destinations, whether that's in small rural communities. The hotel sector has been hit very, very hard. Again, it comes down to cash flow. Again, it comes down to the size of the company to be able to haul itself out. But I think one of the interesting things for the hotel sector in particular is it will have to change its standard operating procedures for the future. As you mentioned earlier, Hannah, you know, in Singapore they have this SG Clean, so you know, the sanitization and the hygiene elements of hotels before they can reopen, that will probably be extended across the region. That obviously will give, hopefully, consumers a bit more security to book hotels, but it's going to increase the costs as well. But we're also going to see that the changing nature of hotel offerings as well. You know, a lot of these big city hotels were based around large ballrooms and dining rooms, meeting and function rooms. You know, that industry isn't going to come back for any time soon, certainly not the largest meetings. So they're going to have to repurpose and find new ways to raise revenue, and that's not going to be easy in a low demand economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And even home sharing, Airbnb came out yesterday, I think, with a whole bunch of suggestions that owners will have to do to ensure hygiene. They don't look particularly easy, and you won't be able to have back-to-back bookings anymore. So yeah, that's going to impact that too in terms of pricing.
Yeah. And then we move into the issue in local communities, which I think is extremely important, because we're seeing, you know, people's livelihoods are being taken away. I got an email yesterday from a friend of mine who owns a hotel in Bali, and he said that, you know, the Bali economy has completely collapsed. You know, everything is closed. Nobody has any work. And he said there's no social safety net here at all. So if people don't have work, they don't have money, they can't feed their families. He's seeing an increase in the rise of crime. Some of the convenience stores are being robbed. There's muggings on the streets. And he said there is a big concern that, you know, this could just get out of control. The local communities are really, really suffering. And if there is no social safety net, now that's not just going to, if people are losing their jobs, it's not just going to impact their ability to travel or even to work. It's going to impact their ability to feed themselves. And, you know, we hope it doesn't get to desperation levels, but I can imagine in some communities across our region, it's a big, big challenge for governments going forward.
Yeah, it is. And like you say, a lot of these, if the countries don't have that kind of social security net for people to fall in as well, that it comes down to a lot of the community trying to support, you know, the rest of the community by giving out free food and things. But that's not really a long-term solution.
No, it's not. And it really goes back to the point, I think, that the Singapore Deputy Prime Minister was saying in that speech that we just referenced earlier, is, you know, tourism really supports communities as well as businesses, as well as, you know, our industry, which is, you know, the lighter side of life. It's about discretionary spending. It's about taking trips. It's about doing business trips. But, you know, it really, really supports people across levels of society. And once that is removed, it's hard to get it back. And one of the issues of actually developing exit strategies for countries, as well as developing their domestic tourism sectors to begin with, Singapore doesn't really have a domestic sector, is how you actually get employment levels back up again, because with low levels of demand, it's going to be hard to pay people. So will we see, you know, things like salaries drop even more? Really hard to know.
Yeah. And I guess the last sector is cruises. I mean, and if you want to know all about cruises, go listen to episode 15 from last week. But obviously, cruise tourism has taken a massive hit as well. And in Southeast Asia, we've seen places like Singapore where cruise arrivals have absolutely plummeted.
Yeah, absolutely true. We discussed this in detail last week. One of the interesting things that probably has come out in the week since is that the cruise sector is, certainly the big cruise operators are really upping their PR campaigns here. They're really trying to promote the fact that they are increasing onboard medical facilities, health and safety protocols. They're also saying that bookings are up for next year, mostly, I guess, with loyal customers. We'll wait and see. But, you know, cruising is kind of its own ecosystem of the travel sector. I think Singapore has a problem because it was really promoting fly cruise. So you're flying from different destinations, particularly Australia, New Zealand. They were really trying to drive that, and India as well. And then you board the cruise ship. So, but that means people have got to fly to get to the cruise. You know, in some of the countries of Europe and particularly the US, where you can actually drive to the cruise port, I think that the recovery will be a bit stronger there, because you actually have control about how you actually get to the embarkation point. I think fly cruising for the near future is going to take a long time to come back.
I think you're right. So that brings us almost to the end of this COVID-19 Rewind edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, it does. We look forward to next is our weekly mini briefing email newsletter, which goes out each Friday and is free to sign up for. Each week, we take a close look at one Southeast Asian country, look at the unfolding tourism situation. The first three issues we've covered the Philippines, Singapore, and Indonesia. And this week for issue four, it's a special regional edition. So we look forward to putting that together in the next few days.
And yeah, and as an extra bonus, subscribers also receive our monthly cheat sheet, which is a concise roundup of the month's key developments in travel and tourism. The January, February, and March cheat sheets are available on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, and our April edition will be published later this week.
Yeah, it certainly will. In the meantime, please send us your comments and insights. We love to read them. Contact us by email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com. Or you can drop us a message via Facebook at The SEA Travel Show, or on Twitter, SEA Travel Show, or via our LinkedIn page, The Southeast Asia Travel Show.
And of course, you can find us on Instagram at SEA Travel Show, where we regularly post images from our travels throughout Southeast Asia.
So, Hannah, that's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to wash our hands with soap and start singing Happy Birthday. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism again very soon.
See you. Bye.